a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? How many are saying of me, God will not deliver him? Selah. But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. Selah. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord. Deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. Now, in our last couple of studies, we looked at what the Jews and the early church referred to as the first psalm. That is Psalms 1 and 2. Now, this first psalm, or these two first psalms, however we want to describe them, set out for us the blessedness of life for those who trust God and who walk in his ways. We saw the first psalm begins, "Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked," and we saw that the second psalm ends with the words, "Blessed are all who take refuge in him." We have this wonderful assertion that those who trust God and who walk in his ways will be blessed by him. Now, despite this assertion of blessedness for God's people and its corresponding assertion of disaster for those who turn away from God to go their own way, whether refusing to trust him, walking in disobedience to his commandments, or rebelling against him, we learn in Psalm 2 that all is not well with the world. We are informed there that there are high-placed enemies of God who have their devious plans for overthrowing God and for overthrowing his kingdom and his Messiah. Yet, Psalm 2 comforts us with a confident declaration that God is completely aware of the purposes of these enemies, and he will not allow their purposes to succeed. Psalm 2 taught us that God has such power that all his enemies will be overthrown, and his messianic king will reign in triumph in Jerusalem. And so the rulers of the world are warned to pay homage to the one true king, to kiss the son, to give him the kiss of homage, lest they be destroyed as they go about their daily lives. Now, Psalm 2, as we saw, ends with a blessing, similar to the blessing at the beginning of Psalm 1. Though this time, the emphasis of the blessing is that those who take refuge in the divine Son will experience God's blessing. Now, that raises a question for us. Refuge from what? If God and his Messiah have such power, why would those who pay homage to him need to be taking refuge from anyone? Surely, we think as we read Psalm 2, with the Messiah reigning from his holy city, why would anyone need to be seeking refuge as if they were fleeing from trouble? Now, in Psalm 3, we learn the answer to such questions. The words, the superscription above the psalm reads, "A psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom." So our question is immediately answered. We do indeed need to take refuge, because we may find ourselves, like David, fleeing David is the one to whom God gave the covenant promises that he would reign in Jerusalem. Wonderful promises, which we saw last time. And David was given the promise by God that his kingdom would never end. David is called by God, when God makes that covenant with him, he is called God's son. He is the king God anointed. And he sat on his throne in Zion, in Jerusalem, by God. David is, of course, the great prototype of the Messiah. In fact, in later prophets like Ezekiel, the Messiah is actually just simply called David, 300 years after David had long passed from the scene. The name David simply becomes a synonym for the Messiah. David is the greatest king of the Old Testament and the greatest prototype as a king of the coming Messiah, the one who will fulfill the covenant completely in the end. That is Jesus himself. Yet here, right after the psalm that is so full of confidence, of sure victory, we find a description of David, the greatest king, the anointed king, the Son of God, fleeing for his life. And what's so remarkable about this scene is that it's not the Philistines or some other age-old enemy of Israel that is seeking to destroy David and wrest the throne from him. It is his own son, Absalom, the son he loves, who has conspired against him. Now, before we look at the psalm in detail, a little background to this might be helpful. Now, if you read 2 Samuel chapters 15 to 18, you'll get the full setting of this prayer of David. Now, you'll remember some years ago when we were studying Women of the Word, I don't know how many years ago that was now, we studied, among other things, the account of Amnon, one of David's sons, brutally raping his half-sister Tamar. And if we had carried on to study the next part of that account, we would have read how Absalom had plotted to kill his half-brother Amnon in vengeance for that rape, because Tamar, Amnon's half-sister, was Absalom's full sister. Absalom and Tamar had the same mother. And Absalom killed Amnon. For a period of 3 years after that murder of his brother, Absalom had to live in exile in the city of Geshur. But eventually David, because he loved Absalom so deeply, had allowed Absalom to return to Jerusalem. Now, even after Absalom's return to Jerusalem, David had initially refused to meet with Absalom. But David was finally prevailed upon by Joab to be fully reconciled to Absalom, to his son. And at that meeting of reconciliation, David embraces Absalom, signifying that he had fully forgiven him and that their relationship was completely restored. And at that meeting, and it's very interesting to read this in 2 Samuel, at that meeting, Absalom professes sorrow and repentance. Now, that part of the story is recorded for us in 2 Samuel 13 and 14. Absalom's exile, his return to Jerusalem, his eventual meeting with David, and their reconciliation. But immediately He is received back by his father and forgiven and restored to relationship with him. Absalom set about carrying out a clever conspiracy to turn the hearts of the people of Israel away from allegiance to his father David and to try to transfer their loyalty to himself instead. And he had a very clever plan. Oh, Absalom waited on a road coming into Jerusalem, the main road coming into Jerusalem, and he intercepted any plaintiff coming to Jerusalem for justice from the king, because that was the king was the supreme justice of the land. If cases could not be resolved at a local level, then the people were told to go to Jerusalem to the king to get difficult cases sorted out. You can read right back to Deuteronomy and it will tell you precisely about that. But Absalom intercepted all these people coming to Jerusalem to get their cases sorted out, and he informed them that everybody in the royal palace was too busy, that there was nobody available to be the king's representative. The king, David, couldn't come himself. He had too much going on, and you can be sure Absalom said a lot of other things as well. And that he had no representatives who could spare the time to hear these cases and give justice. It was like the Supreme Court was closed down. Everybody was off partying. You could imagine the outcry. And Absalom would add to everyone to whom he gave this information, "If only I were appointed judge in the land," i.e. king, "then everyone who has a complaint or a case could come to me and I would make sure that he gets justice." Now, those are his precise words. That's what he says to everybody. At the same time, Absalom had another part of his plan. Whenever anybody would come to bow before him in homage and honor as a royal son, what Absalom would do would prevent them from reacting in that way, and instead he would just lean forward and embrace them and kiss them and welcome them as a friend and as a brother. Now, I sort of say to them, and I'm not some distant ruler, I'm going to be the king who's close to the people. And Absalom carried out this plan for 4 years consistently. Now, as you read the account, it's clear that Absalom is a man with a very charismatic personality. He's also extraordinarily handsome. That's one of the other things we're told about him. He had wonderful hair, among other things. But he was a very handsome young man. And this personality and his personal attractiveness in every way, together with his very devious and careful undermining of the people's allegiance to David and his efforts to turn their hearts to himself, had the desired effect. So when he thinks he's got enough people on his side, what he does is he goes to David and he asks David if he can go to Hebron, because he says, "I made a vow to God to worship him there," which is just an absolute pack of lies. But David gives him permission to go. Now, once Absalom is away from Jerusalem, from the capital city, he sends his henchmen, his messengers, secretly throughout the land and begins to gather an army together from those whose loyalties he had won. His work had been so effective at undermining loyalty to David that there were far more of the people acknowledging his leadership than there were remaining true to David. The next stage of his rebellion is to begin to march on Jerusalem. And given the size of his army, a much larger army than David's, David has little choice but to flee from the city. And you can read in Samuel the account of David fleeing from the city. He goes barefoot and weeping with his head covered in shame and sorrow as he goes. And as David goes out of the city into the country to escape from his son and his son's army, there are people taking advantage of him who come out and who curse him and who throw dirt at him. So he goes out in humiliation from his own capital city. This is the greatest king of the Old Testament. People curse him and call him a scoundrel who has been abandoned by God. Now, this is the setting of the psalm that we're looking at today. A little background helps, doesn't it? Now, we should notice how the psalm is filled with the language of battle all the way through, of foes, of people rising up, of deliverance, of shields, and so on, tens of thousands, etc., enemies. There's language of the battle all the way through. If you look at the language carefully, you'll see that the language in 2 Samuel is very similar. The two passages are linguistically tied together. The other thing we should notice, too, is that Psalm 3 is called a morning psalm, while Psalm 4 is called an evening psalm. And the reasons for those, if you look in chapter 3, verse 5, it says, I lie down and sleep. And in Psalm 4, verse 5, verse 8, it says, I will lie down and sleep in peace. In Psalm 3, he lies down and sleeps and wakes again because the Lord sustains him. Psalm 4 talks about him lying down in peace. So Psalm 3 is a morning psalm. Psalm 4 is an evening psalm. Now, this is the first of the psalms that is explicitly said to be composed for singing with musical accompaniment. Its title, A Psalm of David, the Hebrew word there for a psalm, means precisely that. This is a psalm to be sung with music. And the psalm is set out in four stanzas, or verses, and as you can see, stanza one is the first two verses. Stanza 2 is verses 3 and 4. Stanza 3 is verses 5 and 6. And stanza 4 is verses 7 and 8. And you'll notice when I read it, I added in the word Selah, which you see there three times. After stanza 1, stanza 2, and stanza 4. Now, we're not absolutely certain of the meaning of Selah, but it's clearly a musical term, and we can be almost sure, actually there's very little doubt about this, that the term Selah simply signifies forte, if you saw that on a piece of piano music or any other music, for example. It signifies that those sections, stanza 1, stanza 2, and stanza 4, should be accompanied with louder music, with stronger music. And as you look at the psalm, it's very obvious that the third stanza should be sung more quietly. It's talking about lying down and sleeping. So that's just a little bit about the background. Now, as we look at the psalm itself, stanza 1 is a lament of David, reflecting on his having to flee from his capital city, Jerusalem. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. His enemies are indeed many, as he repeats three times. These first three lines are parallel to each other. This is indeed the truth, because the majority of the people had sided with Absalom. This isn't a small rebellion. That's why David has to leave the city. David's foes are confident that God is no longer on his side. Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. Whether Absalom and his supporters believed that Absalom was God's choice for the throne, we're not told, either in this psalm or in the historical account in 2 Samuel. Absalom himself appears to have a total disregard for God, because he clearly lies about his intention to go to Hebron to worship God. He's not going to worship God at all. He's going to gather his forces secretly. But in Samuel and in the psalm, David's enemies had concluded, we're told, that David had been abandoned by God, that he was no longer to be regarded as the Lord's anointed. But just as God had set Saul aside, so God was going to set David aside. David knows God will restore his glory. Even though he had had to leave Jerusalem with his head bowed and covered in shame, he is confident that God will lift up his head again. That is, will give him honor once more among his people. That's David's confidence. Even though the majority of the nation has turned against him, he's confident that God will cause him to be honored once again.